This is Sci-Fi Tech Talk.
Welcome to Sci-Fi Tech Talk, the podcast where we explore the technology of sci-fi. I'm Jeff Sire, and with me today is Mike McPeak.
Hello.
And Julie Keel.
Hey, everybody.
And we're finally together to record this steaming pile of poop, which is, today is Barbarella. As we said before when we were talking, just before we started recording, we have some opinions on Barbarella. So we're it's a 1968 film, and the synopsis is Barbarella is marked by the same audacity and originality, fantasy, humor, beauty and horror, cruelty and eroticism that make comic books such a favorite. Okay, that's my fault. The setting is the planet Lithion in the year 40,000, round number, when Barbara, I'm just going to continue to do these little side barbs. When Barbarella makes a forced landing while traveling through space, which is more like a pie plate thrown across a sound stage, she acts like a female James Bond vanquishing evil in the forms of robots and monsters. He also rewards in an uninhibited manner, or
yeah,
sexist manner, the handsome men who assist her in the adventure. While she is wrestling with black guards and evil queen, or Angel Pygar, he just can't seem to avoid losing at least part of her skin tight swimsuit.
Ain't that the truth?
Yes. What a horrendous.
Yeah, you know, I'm just done with these, you know, like 1960, late 60s, early 70s movies. I'm just done with them. We're not doing any of them ever again.
Yeah.
Between this one and the Man Who Fell to Earth, which also, by the way, we had a listener write in, leave a comment, and say, we ought to read the book of The Man Who Fell to Earth. He says it's like Starship Troopers, where the movie is absolute crap, but the book's pretty good. So thank you for that, because I don't know if we'd have gone out and looked for that. Maybe someday in the future we can come back and revisit that, but... That movie and this movie, I mean, what... I made the comment this earlier this morning, too. I'm like, you know, if this is what the science fiction was in the 70s, no wonder Star Wars blew everybody away. I mean, yeah. Star Wars, to a large extent, holds up today. This crap does not.
Well, yeah, and, you know, okay, and, you know, I'll take the bullet for this one. I'm the one that, you know, put it in here, but, yeah, and it is a, you know, like, say, a fluffy piece of crap, but I do think it was, I do look at it as kind of representative of that time frame of the 60s, and, okay, maybe we've got enough reference points that we can skip by anymore.
Yeah.
But this came out the same year as 2001 A Space Odyssey, and it is a totally different attitude.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Attitude, but I think, you know, if you look at some of the, how am I trying to say this, some of the themes or some of the stuff that they were doing, there is certain, you know, a lot of science fiction now is, you know, dystopian future. This one and, you know, 2001, they were more, you know, optimistic about the future. You know, in Barbarella, you didn't have a society collapse. You had an evil guy, but you always have to have something to battle. But it wasn't like society had collapsed. It hadn't done a lot of that stuff. And I think, you know, from about, you know, and this is just my perception of things, but I think from about the end of World War II till about the end of the 60s there was this time when, you know, science fiction was about optimism. It was about what we could do to improve the world, what science was going to do to, you know, save the world. And then it seemed like when the 70s and the Vietnam War and a lot of other things, at least in the United States here, came along, we started to get into more darker, you know, science fiction. And so I think this movie here, you know, is like, say, kind of a representative slice of what people thought science could do and what they kind of thought about the future.
Actually, I don't see it at all that way. I see this as like an earlier Flash Gordon. It's just total, you know, the intro called it comic books, you know, basically comic book type stuff. And that's kind of, I mean, it's science fiction because it's not, you know, like murder mystery. But I don't think there's any science, and I think it's all fiction. And the only thing that plants it in there is the year 40,000. And yeah, I get that. There is some science, because we'll talk about it. Yeah.
Well, science fiction to a certain extent, is always a reflection on the current time that it's and the viewpoints and all that of the people and the time that it's created. So if you look at this and compare it to 2001 coming out in the same year, 2001 was made by people who were working at NASA, working feverishly to put somebody on the moon. This was made by the drugged out hippies that were at, you know, UC Davis, like high on LSD. So, which were all existing in at the same time in the same country, but just totally different points of view. And like, this is all the hippie love people that made this.
Yeah, and that, you know, that continues for eternity. I mean, you have various pockets of society always, you know, whatever we consider to be quote-unquote the norm for the time. Believe me, there's a lot of people who don't follow whatever that norm is, and that norm isn't normal anyway.
But to give this movie its due, I was looking through the trivia there. It does hold the distinction for being the first comic book turned into a movie, and so by and therefore the first female protagonist comic book character, you know, to have a movie.
Okay, let me be clear too. I don't regret watching this because I feel it's like, you know, it is one of those touch points. It's a classic in a cultish sort of way, I suppose. But it does, if you had to list the top, I don't know, it might have to be more than 100 science fiction. But it has its place. We'll put it that way. It just has its place. And again, I don't regret watching it, but I don't know I've ever cared to watch it again. And I'm not going to spend a lot of brain time on trying to figure out what its meanings and messages were and whether or not it's, you know, got anything to tell us for current day.
When 'cause I was a kid in the 80s, this is one of those posters that was always, you know, up at all of the video stores, and this was all something that I always, you know, 16-year-old Jeff was very interested in seeing this movie.
Well, duh.
48-year-old Jeff is not, you know, was gravely disappointed, and it's too bad that 16-year-old Jeff didn't get to see this, because he might have appreciated it a lot.
Right. Well, because I sent out a tweet to you guys before we started, and I called it Booberella. That's both on a metaphysical and a physical level. And, you know, you said, you know, Flash Gordon. It more like there was a movie out that I haven't really seen called Flesh Gordon, which I think would probably be more appropriate for this movie. But
yeah, it's, you know, it is what it is. And I got to imagine it was, you know, a blast to make, but yeah. Anyway, there is virtually no message to this. It is a 2-hour romp of fantasy, complete fantasy. Yeah. I guess I wouldn't even call it, again, I struggle with calling it science fiction, but
there, this movie does have one weird claim to fame. That the band Duran Duran got their name from a character in the movie, which I think you'd be hard pressed to, like, bands get their names from weird inspirations, but I can't think of any other band names that come from characters in movies. I'm sure there are ones, but this is the one that I'd known about this for years, and I thought it was kind of neat, but.
They did change the spelling slightly. In the movie, it's Durand, and it ends with a D, and of course the band leaves the last D off. But yeah, no, that you couldn't miss that connection. Okay, let's actually talk about some of the science and tech in here, because, again, I consider it, you know, way more fiction than science, but it had some neat stuff in there as far as very campy as hell, right? Let's just go there. It's just campy as hell. But, you know, they did have a computer that looked like, I don't know, a wall of flashing lights, but you know, the whole voice control thing and asking questions was, you know, fiction, science fiction in 1968. My phone would do that now.
Well, yeah, and we finally gotten to the point, because as I'm talking here, I have two, you know, digital assistants who I dare not say their name or they're going to start squawking at us here.
Right.
But, you know, we're now to that point that what they envisioned in the 60s is kind of finally starting to come to fruition, and right now we're still taking, you know, child steps with this stuff. But you know, I can sit here until my sisters turn the lights on, or I've got a video doorbell so I can tell it to see what's going on. So we are kind of getting to that point that they envisioned in this movie.
Yeah, and some of the things not so much, you know, yay. You know, like the shag carpet spacecraft.
Oh, God, yeah. Shag carpet.
Yeah.
I'm just having bad flesh.
I'm traumatized here.
If you have
here.
Shag carpet, the obvious place to put it is in your spaceship.
Right.
Or your 69 Impala, one or the other.
Well, yeah, and apparently space travel must be really, smooth, because there's no place to strap yourself in, even though at one point she bores through a planet and comes out on the other side. You know, in a movie like Barbarella, you make all the boring jokes however you want to do it. You know,
all of them would be appropriate. Every single one.
Yes, on multi-levels. But, if you're, tunneling through a planet, you would think you'd want to maybe, it could potentially be a bumpy ride, but no, you're just rolling around on your shag carpet, shagging each other, whatever it is, because free love's a thing.
Yeah.
Actually, they do a good job of, I can't even remember what this thing is called, but it's that electronic porn device that it transmits that sensation.
You mean
that's a real thing, and they have something similar to that in this movie. I don't know what it's called, but like, yeah.
You mean the one where they take the pills and they have sex by touching their hands?
Yes.
If that's the future, if that's the future, I don't want it. No. No. There's a reason, I don't want to go around touching people's hands. No, it's that's just wrong. my opinion anyway. Yeah, give me the old fashioned where you actually have to do put a little work into it, whatever.
This movie. Yeah. Just the premise of that, we can talk about that, but the film, the actual visuals of that were comical. They're nothing but comical. God, anyway.
Yes, because they are so advanced, they move beyond, this primitive stuff. And then she kind of goes, and then she finds out, hey, this primitive stuff isn't all that bad. So, I don't know. They're trying to be, I think a little high-minded. And it's just like, no, not really.
Well, that's actually, that theme comes back time and time again. The fact that at some point we will consider sex and childbirth and all of that kind of stuff to be primitive because, dirty, disgusting, sweaty, painful, all of those things, risky. We shouldn't be doing that. That's barbaric.
I don't consider that actually too far, too unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't either.
I think it's far-fetched. But, we've gone through, in the 60s, when this was filmed, there was a cycle of time where breastfeeding fell out of, not out of norm, but there was a
better living through chemistry.
That felt no, the best thing for your baby is the formula, and people bought into that, and breastfeeding shouldn't do that, it's not good for your baby. And there were people that believed that and went that way for a while, and I could totally see a day where there would be a push on to say, oh no, you can have a much better baby engineered if you do it.
Yeah, and I can see that being insurance companies pushing it because it's much less risky.
Yeah.
Right.
It's cheaper.
You just have a little pod somewhere, and probably some check marks. So, what do you want your child to look like? So it will be completely engineered people.
Yeah, like Borg.
And the problem when you start engineering things like that, because they discovered that in, different crops, that when you have too much sameness, eventually that leads to problems because of either lack of resistance to disease or, you know, adaptability or whatever. So, you know, they may think this is a, you know, grand idea where you can just go through and, you know, engineer your kids. But, you know, I could see somewhere in the future that coming back to bite.
Oh, absolutely. That's a theme that shows up in science fiction continually. Good science fiction story has something about, you know, the machines don't know better than the humans. All of our, I mean, everything goes back to Star Trek. All our foibles and, you know, bad personality traits and evil and dirty and whatever. If we lose it, hell, Firefly, I just watched Serenity a couple weeks ago. You know, Reavers, they tried to engineer out all of the anger in people, and what happened, you know, it was 1%. It went the other way, you know. So, yeah, that whole thing.
And,
comes
and you
back
see that in every field, the whole unforeseen circumstances. Like there was a thing in New Delhi, like in the 1800s, they had too many cobras because people were training cobras. So they said, okay, well, they put a bounty on cobras, and apparently they have excess of cobras to this day because people started breeding the cobras just to get the bounty, and then when they discontinued the program, people just released thousands of cobras into the street.
Right. Or rabbits in Australia.
Yeah. Like, you know, these things that start out just like, won't be a big deal. Like the Great Lakes.
Yep.
With the introduction of the zebra mussels. Oh, no, it's, you know, like it's going to be terrible. It's going to do this. Well, then it filters the water so clean that now we have massive algae problems because algae grows way deeper in the lakes now than it ever used to because the sun can penetrate so much further because the lakes are so much cleaner than they used to.
Yeah.
Like, it's just all of these, you know, you make a change in one area and you can't really foresee all of the trickle-down effects of it.
Right. Yeah, and I just watched an episode of DS9 where they had all the mutants together trying to predict the future of the war with Cardassian. And, you know, all of these savants basically had figured out everything, and they decided that the best solution was to surrender. And then one person made one different choice, and suddenly all of those equations fell by the wayside, and you know, yeah, nobody can predict with that kind of certainty. I don't care how smart or how many variables or how much computing power you put behind it. So that's, like I say, that's just kind of an ongoing theme in science fiction. But yeah, so if Barbarella, you know, they were oh god, anyway, even like the transport. We're talking about the shag carpet and the spaceship, but there was like a stasis chamber in it as well. That was that whole concept of, you know, trying to travel great distances needed a stasis chamber. But it was set in a story that, you know, it was like, oh yeah, we need you to go do this thing. Oh, I'll be there in like, you know, tomorrow type of thing. The internal consistencies in here were fast and loose, basically.
Well, then so was Barbarella.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
You set that one up perfectly.
I did.
Yeah.
I really, really did, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well then, yeah, moving on from that unfortunate remark. You were talking about transportation, you know, and then they had the more... I don't quite want to call it steampunk, but they had that wind wagon, which in theory is interesting. How practical it is, probably isn't practical at all, but actually, you know, in theory, it's an interesting idea.
Actually, I think that's historic.
Is it?
I think so. I think there was a time when the problem is that trying to, in the United States at least, most settlers in a wagon we're going east to west, and the prevailing winds are west to east. So, for the most part, big generalities there. So, you know, like setting up a sail on a wagon would oftentimes not be productive because it'd be pushing you the wrong way.
Sure.
But I do think that happened on occasion, where they literally put sails on wagons to help get across the prairies.
Yeah, because while you were talking, I Googled it, and I'll drop it into chat here. But yeah, there's this. I came in Wikipedia, or no, the Kansapedia from Kansas, of course, because it's flat and windy out there. But anyway, yeah, they had there's a picture of a wind wagon there, which is just basically a wagon, just a flatbed really with high wheels and a sail on it. I hadn't had time to peruse the whole thing here, but
yeah.
So apparently it was a thing, and like I say, in Kansas, and like I say, it's going to depend upon which way the wind is blowing, literally, for it to work. But so it is a thing, so I shouldn't poo-poo it.
Yeah, but what was yeah, okay, for starters, they landed, Barbarella landed on a frozen lake. Yeah, and then a wind wagon comes along. If it truly was a frozen lake and a wind wagon, and depending on, you know, friction and strength of the wind, a wind wagon could actually be blown sideways as opposed to the direction you wanted to go. So that was interesting. But
actually, a wind skating device, because at least your skates would dig in. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would have been more from, of all the things we could pick apart in this movie, we're picking on that one.
I know.
Yeah.
But it was kind of an interesting one thing that Barbarella did is it kind of mixed, technologies, I guess. You called it steampunk, and that's fair. There was more than a few things that were steampunk. A couple things that were really, science fiction-y, like the computers and some of the display screens and stuff. There were other things that were, for lack of a better term, I'll call them alien. They just, or fantasy, perhaps. They just, they were just BS.
I was going to say fantasy, or I don't quite want to say biblical, because Pygar, I guess they did call him an angel.
Yep, they did.
So I don't know where you want to put draw the line between fantasy and or biblical.
The guy with the wings, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And there was the whole labyrinth there, and there was some. I don't know if they were trying to make some sort of statement on society with like the slaves and the labyrinth and whatever. I don't think so, because it didn't really work. But yeah, you had the evil queen, you had the drug den, you had I don't remember the guy's name. The guy who's driving the wind wagon, the kind of the mountain man out there, the outdoors dude. There was all kinds of different little chunks of or scenarios of different types of lifestyles, I guess. And it was just, they were so jammed together that they made no sense. I mean, it just, yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of the Chinese menu of science fiction movies. Get a couple from column A, a couple from column B, and one from column C or something like that.
And don't forget, you can also get a hamburger at the Chinese buffet. It's like, great.
Yeah. It was kind of a weird mishmash of stuff. And yeah, but, at least, I don't know. I'm not trying to necessarily justify this movie, but at least, they were thinking that, instead of having one homogenous society, it was made up of different things. So,
I'll give them credit too. They not only was it not homogenous, it also wasn't. I don't know how to say, like, the same time period. I mean, seriously, like a wind wagon next to Pygar, next to the drug den. It felt like different time periods in all of those.
Right.
So it wasn't just like little different pockets of society. It felt like you were, traveling in time, I guess, a little bit.
Or at least traveling across a society that's got different, much like traveling across, America here.
Cause yeah.
You can travel from one end to the other, and you will see, maybe not as diverse as this, but you can go from like the Amish to Silicon Valley in the same country here.
Oh,
so.
Heck. Amish country. You can go from Amish country to the X Games within 5 miles.
Right.
So, But yeah, it's, I I'm trying to come up with some redeeming values for this movie, and other than just a fun two-hour romp, okay, fun is stretching it. How about just a two-hour romp? Because, you know, romp. And there was no message to this movie. There just really wasn't. I think if we're trying to read stuff into it, we're doing it a disservice. It was not meant to do that.
Well, I think the message might be get stoned. I mean, I don't know. That might be it. But.
Free love,
you know,
it
struck
stoned.
Me as the kind of movie that would be okay if it was on in the background in a, like a... Yeah, strip joint,
right.
Bar or something.
Yeah.
Like if this was on the TVs in the background, this
yeah.
is, this is like this
oh,
weird kind of
if you were at
background.
The marijuana house, and I'm if you were at the hippy dippy trippy rugs on the wall house and this was playing on the TV, that would be completely in context.
Well, yeah, because she's got rugs in a spaceship.
Yeah,
so why not?
I just put that together anyway, but yeah.
Because this is basically a stoner movie. You know,
basically.
Take a few puffs and watch this, and maybe it'll make sense until you sober
up. Far more enjoyable drunk or something, yeah. You know, I will give credit to the translator thingy. It did start out where at least it did have this, where she lands on some planet and she can't understand the language. I'm like, thank you. At least that happened. But so she did have some translator thingy that she had to make happen so that she could understand them. But then, of course, it all went away for everybody. But yeah, that that and the positronic ray were two things that stood out to me. It's like, yeah, that's kind of Star Trek-y. You have to have the universal translator, and then you had a positronic ray. I don't know. Must have been a big thing in the late 60s.
Yeah, it's a word that it sounds science fiction that you throw it out there, because now, you know, Data's got a positronic brain. Don't
right.
know what that
yep.
means exactly. But, you know, and as you're talking about stuff, I'm looking at the show notes here, and sandwiched in between those two things, you have the piano torture device. What did they call it? The extreme. But in the book, it was called the Orgasmatron, I think it was. Yeah, no, let's be subtle about it. Well, at least in the movie, they didn't go for the, you know, completely obvious, but it was the extreme. I forget what it was. Extreme something or another. But yeah, that was a way of torturing people by pleasuring them to death. But of course, Barbarella, being who she is, you know, defeated the machine. So, okay. Write your own jokes there.
Yeah. Just. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even from a filmmaker's standpoint, a pleasure machine could have been portrayed in an infinite number of ways. For it to basically be organ pedals and or a xylophone or something, a wooden xylophone, just. Yeah, no, that was
okay.
So bad.
Just think about what you just said. You just called it an organ machine. So, again,
sorry.
We're writing our own.
God. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Like, nothing.
No. And like I say, with these, the jokes write themselves in here. You know, like I say, it's almost like when I'm on Geekish or whatever, I say things and somebody takes out of context. This whole movie, you don't even have to take it out of context. You can just sit there and, you know, it writes its own jokes, and you just sit there and go, yep, they just said that.
Yeah.
Without even thinking about it.
Yeah, it's a thing. It really is a thing. I don't know what to say.
You know, what I would like to know, though, I mean, okay, you know, we're mocking this movie for science fiction, but I would like to know how true it is to the, because it's based on a French comic series or something like that. I'd like to know how faithful it is to that. I mean, is this more or less what they envisioned and they, you know, sort of just made it into a film version, or did they,
well,
you know, take it even more than the comic book did?
I was just reading up on the Barbarella comics, and they said it was one of the first comics that was considered pornography, so it probably is somewhat in line with the comic book. So.
Right, and of all the comic books you could have chose to, you know, like turn into a film, that's got to be the one. Oh, God, the 1960s. I'm so glad you're dead.
Well, yeah, and for the 60s, it's probably made sense. I wouldn't quite call Barbarella pornography. Slutty, yeah, but probably not.
It certainly is not, you know, like X-rated.
No.
And I wouldn't even go so far to call it soft porn, although there are, you know, nudity and whatever. But the underlying theme and vibe is certainly in that camp. It's
The free love. I had to look it up because I had to look up The Summer of Love, which was 67. So this is at the tail end of that. You know, and it's kind of the whole, the hippy dippy, you know, free love. We're going to change the world through love. You know, I don't remember when John Lennon had his Love In or whatever it was called. That may have been more or less that time. You know, we were putting a lot of stock in love can change the world, and I think that's what the vibe they were trying to go for. And so, you know, maybe with us looking back at jaded eyes and all the things that's happened between now and then, it does seem pretty stupid and pretty campy. But I think they, up to a point, more or less sincerely believed that this could, at the time, could work. Again, some of those thoughts may have been drug induced, but
yeah. Well, I'll give the 60s again. The 60s, trying to characterize the 60s is kind of stupid. It can't be characterized. But, you know, the whole birth control revolution, you know, which then turned into the free love revolution, which then turned into the, you know, hippie thing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Just one thing built upon another. It was a series of events, and they were all dependent upon each other. Yeah, this movie certainly fits into that rolling, you know, experience of the 60s, I guess. And on the flip side of that, the other part of it is, you know, all of the sexism and racism of the 60s, you know, and the war going on and you know, all of the negative sides, too. I mean, it was 60s. I'll give it credit. It was probably a decade in the history of mankind that will never be repeated. There was a lot that went down in the 60s, both good and bad.
Sure, yeah.
Well, you know, and I would be kind of curious, you know, if I live long enough to look back in 50 years and see what people think of. Yeah, because it's almost, next year would be 50 years that this movie came out, right? So to go back, you know, if I live to be long enough, look back in 50 years and see what people think of what we were doing now and how much maybe they would mock us or, you know, it's easy to look back and mock it because you think at the present time you're just the coolest people in the world. And then, you know, you get historic perspective and it's like, no, you guys are kind of idiots.
Right. You know, go back and look at any 80s, you know, like snapshots. Just,
oh, Lord.
Yeah, I know. Right. Right. Just right there. But also, too, we are judging this movie, and we judge everything we do here, on technology and or some sort of message or some sort of story or something. And, you know, I don't think Barbarella was shooting for any of that. That was not their purpose. They didn't want to portray realistic science or technology. They didn't want to portray a story that had a message or a moral to the story. You know, that was, they just wanted to have this, you know, what'd they call it?
Titillating.
Yeah, the tagline, there was a tagline for it that was called the space age adventuress whose sexploits are among the most bizarre ever seen. You know, and if that's your purpose, okay, you did a pretty good job. You know, I'll give them credit for having, you know, it was Barbarella, and like we were saying, it is a female protagonist or adventurer. She was a pilot. She was out on her own. She was almost taking care of herself. Not really.
She was more like, she was just kind of, it wasn't so much taking care of herself. She just got lucky a lot because at the beginning of the movie, she's captured by these kids and they're, you know, trying to kill her with dolls with razor sharp teeth. And this guy comes along and rescues her. It's a lot of, right. Okay, again, this goes back to the sexism. Yep. A lot of her being rescued a lot.
Yep. Yeah, there was a whole lot of her being rescued. It was tiring.
And then after she's rescued, she pays him back with sex.
Right, so. I was going to say, and it was a whole lot of sleeping your way to the top. So, yeah, but you got to start somewhere. At least she was the focus of the story. She was a pilot of a spaceship.
Yeah.
I don't think Wonder Woman would have approved of this.
I don't think so either.
No. No.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman may have beat the crap out of her just for reasons.
But it's, I guess,
yeah. Well, then I went on this little tangent. I was trying to see if there's any significance to the name Pygar. I really couldn't find any. But, you know, the other name that really kind of stuck out with me was Dildando.
Oh, my God. I missed that. How did I miss that?
Well, that was the guy that storms the after she's captured. He leads the resistance to storm the castle or whatever it is and saves her from the what was the black essence that
essence of man?
No, that was before
the
that.
Black, yeah, warriors or whatever.
Well, why am I not seeing the show notes here? Here, you got it here. Mathmos.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the evil essence or whatever it was supposed to portray that was just sucking the life out of. People. So he's the one that rushes in, and the only thing that protects her from the Mathos is her intense goodness or whatever it was. So her and the Evil Queen, because she's near the Evil Queen is near Barbarella, this her innate goodness protects him from the Mathos. It wasn't because of any talent she had, it was just because of her essence that she was saved. So, you know, really, what skill? Apparently she piloted a ship, but what skill did Barbarella have in this, outside of, well, you know, certain carnal skills, but yeah.
She was highly skilled in that area.
Yes.
Yeah, no, the rest of the skills were basically luck, you know, being rescued at the right time. Yeah, it's an interesting,
Well, it's a... interesting movie to make fun of, I guess, which occasionally we need to have these here, but yeah, it'll be good to get back to something, you know, hard science and, you know, a lot less fluffy than this thing is.
Yeah, I needed maybe a break from hard science, and we've had quite enough of this fluffy stuff for a while. I just totally do not want to see another 60s or 70s movies until, you know, like Christmas.
I just read the most interesting quote. Planet of the Apes came out in the same year, and there's this line, Film Quarterly concluded that in the year that Stanley Kubrick, who did 2001, and Franklin Schaffner, who did Planet of the Apes, finally elevated the science fiction movie beyond the abyss of the kiddie show, Roger Vadim, who did this movie, has knocked it right back down. That was very succinct and right to the point.
Yeah, I can't agree more.
Yeah, because those were two, you know, Planet of the Apes and 2001, they were both, you know, pivotal movies in the whole science fiction genre. And you know, Barbarella was probably pivotal too, but not for all the good reasons. But.
I could make an exception to my rule for the original Planet of the Apes. I could possibly do that, but not soon. Because even watching Soylent Green back when we did, I mean, again, an important movie that everyone should see. It's a classic, but it still is a 60s movie.
This is considered to have had an impact in its imagery, like the way it looks.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Right.
Yeah. Like it's, I think, yeah, this was pretty kind of maybe groundbreaking for that kind of, like the shag carpety look, the really kind of spacey way everything was looked. Maybe, like you said, like this is, you know, there is some steampunk elements, but like well before steampunk was even a thing, right?
And there was, I mean, it definitely feels like a 60s movie, too. The spaceship feels like a 60s apartment, you know, right. shag carpet, plastic molded chairs, just that whole, a lot of curves, not a lot of straight edges or angles, you know.
I think stylistically it's representative of a lot of, you know, movies of the science fiction movies or movies in general of the 60s. Cause I remember, you know, there's a lot of these, you know, the newfangled chairs that they were going to have all these like egg chairs or whatever, you know, that was all these futuristic designs that we tried out for a while. And then we just went back to regular chairs. So I think, you know, that time for not, and not just science fiction movies, but a lot of movies in general was, they were experimenting with different designs, different ideas, this kind of stuff, and just putting them all in there. But like I said, I think once the newness of that wore off, we just go back to let's just have a chair. Nothing doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to do any weird crap. It just, we just need a chair. So I think in, you know, as far as filmmaking in general goes, it's just a stylistic experimentation.
Yeah,
definitely a product of its time.
Definitely, definitely. The special effects, yeah. There's a scene at the beginning where basically Barbarella is waking up from stasis and pulling her space suit off and is trying to appear as if it's in zero gravity.
Forever.
Yeah, I know, because, you know, it's erotic. You know, they even talk about how the credits at the beginning were moved around to cover up basically nudity. It's like, yeah, because, yeah. But watching that, I was trying to figure out how they were filming it. Near as I can come up with it, she was laying on a chunk of glass and rolling around or whatever.
Yeah.
And then comparing that to like some of the weightless scenes in Gravity, we've come a long ways in portraying weightlessness on film. But I will also say that actually Barbarella, that particular scene, as much as it's annoying by the time it's over, the weightless feeling is pretty decent. I mean,
for a low-budget film, yeah. In context, yeah, somewhere in the trivia, it was plexiglass she laid on it and rolled around. Yeah. So they shot it from the bottom up. But, you know, to give them a little credit, because, you know, we've been harshing on them pretty bad here. But to give them a little credit, that wasn't a bad special effect for the time. I mean, it could have been something really cheesy where they had her up on strings and doing something, you know.
Right.
They just went with something simple and effective, and it worked. Yeah, was it the best? No, but for the time, it was okay. And I don't think that they probably spent a lot on costumes and design, but I don't think they spent a lot on special effects. I don't remember any real groundbreaking or any interesting special effects.
There was some with some of the weapons, I think, you know, had like, you know, like phaser fire type stuff for special effects. But, you know, think back to the original Star Trek series. That's special effects are pretty bad there, too. So it was par for its time. I had a thought.
Do you have any other tech we want to talk about?
Oh, you were talking about the filmmaking, the sets. I'll give the designers credit for coming up with some pretty interesting, you know, the visually interesting sets to film the various locations on. You had, you know, the ice lake, and you had the den of, I don't know, women smoking on the hookah, and you had a labyrinth, and you had, well,
I would bet though that almost all of those were straight out of the comic book.
It could be, but I think they did a decent job visually with those, the costumes and the sets and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of the same thing I felt about The Man Who Fell to Earth, because even though the story was a little weird, at least the visuals, you know, kept me entranced enough that I didn't, you know, I wasn't zoning out on the movie, because just something about the colors and the everything they were doing from kind of an artistic, stylistic, you know, point of view, at least that held my attention. And maybe just because it's so different from what we're doing now, and they're, for me, probably a little bit of nostalgia because I did grow up during the 60s. So, you know, for me, maybe it was a combination of how much things have changed, but also reminiscing just a little bit about things. So, but the style of both of those movies, yeah, it just, it was enough to I think that was one of the justifications for this movie, is just kind of the style of it and the, you know, how they presented things that I thought was relevant.
Cool. Yeah. There's not much to this movie, though.
No.
There's just not a lot of meat to it.
I
really need to stop softballing this.
Well, with this movie, you can't help it. Everything just seems like a double entendre. I mean, like I say, the jokes almost write themselves. You just can't help but say anything, and it just comes out that way because it is that way. But so basically, I think this movie has kind of left us somewhat speechless. We're foundering for words now.
And I think we should maybe just skip the what sort of tech we would want.
Yeah, because if anybody says the piano torture thingy, I'm just you're done. No, you're off the show.
No. Let's just say that there's nothing that any of us would admit to.
Okay, that sounds safe enough.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't mention anything about shag carpet.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay. How about the shag carpet?
No, I had that. No, best left, let it go away to the dodo.
Well, I guess that wraps up this episode of Sci-Fi Tech Talk. You can check us out at scifitechtalk.com or follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Tech Talk. If you have any ideas or comments, please send them to greetings@scifitechtalk.com, and reviews on iTunes are always welcome. Mike, where can people find you?
If you want to know more about me, you can follow me on Twitter at DSC Chipman, and I have an about.me page at about.me. About.me/Mike McPeak. That's MCPEEK. And if you also want to hear other stuff that I have to talk about where I can be misinterpreted, you can go listen to me on Geekiest Show Ever at geekiestshowever.com.
Okay. And Julie, where can people find you?
I too can be found on Twitter at Julie Kiel, JulieKuehl. And links to the other blogs, podcasts, and whatever else I've got going on can be found at about.me/Julie Kiel.
All right. People can follow me on Twitter at Bronco Sire. That's S-Y-E-R. And next episode, we'll be covering the 2013 movie based on the 1964 novel Hard to Be a God. And the synopsis is a group of scientists is sent to the planet... Oh, no.
Arcanar.
Yeah. Arcanar, is that right?
Sure.
Okay. To help the local civilization, which is in the medieval phase of its own history. To find the right path to progress. Their task is a difficult one. They cannot interfere violently, and in no case can they kill. The scientist, Rumata, tries to save the local intellectuals from their punishment, and cannot avoid taking a position. As if the question were, what would you do in God's place? Director's statement, Arkizel. What the hell?
Alexei
wanted to make this film his entire life. The road was a long one. This is not a film about cruelty, but about love. A love was there, tangible, alive, and restrained through the hardest of conditions. Wow. That will be interesting.
I was going to say, nobody knows what we're in for the next one.
And none of us have seen this, right?
No, and it's a foreign film. So,
okay. It should be interesting.
Yep.
So that's it for this show, and we'll see you in the future.
It's the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.